on News Talk 1290 CJBK, London's premier forum for news, views, and up-to-date information. Here's Andy Udman.
As I always like to say on Thursday morning, this is your captain speaking. Fasten your seatbelts. We are about to hit turbulence. I have a question for you this morning, folks. Do you trust your family doctor with your very life? I have three words for you. You will recognize them. Vioxx, Avandia, thalidomide. Pam Colleen is in the house this morning. Pam, remind us about Vioxx.
Well, the scandal in and around Vioxx was that basically the company that manufactured the product hid some data. They withheld data that was showing that people taking Vioxx during trials were dying from heart attacks or strokes, and they left it out. They thought it was irrelevant, and unfortunately, the calculations to date say that about 60,000 people have died because of that drug.
Isn't that a crime?
Well, you know, they've been fined into the billions of dollars, but it's a slap in the wrist. It's just a drop in the bucket for a company that's made huge profits from selling that drug.
Avandia.
Well, Avandia, I think a lot of your listeners will be familiar with some of the commercials we've been seeing on TV lately showing that there's a class action lawsuit against Avandia, and that if anybody's been injured from taking that drug, that they're to contact a law firm. So again, there you see taking that drug had increased the rates of things like heart attacks in people taking that drug. So it's, again, another risky drug.
And the third word, which makes everybody absolutely shudder because it needs no explanation, thalidomide.
Yeah, well, thalidomide happened right here in Canada. It did not happen in the United States. The U.S. government actually did not allow for that drug to hit the markets for the purposes outlined for pregnant mothers. So unfortunately, today here in Canada, we still see the after effects of mothers who took that drug during pregnancy.
We all have this illusion that we have doctors in white jackets who are so smart and so educated, and who have studied drugs and medicine generally for so many years, that they are a firewall between us and drugs which can harm us.
Mm-hmm. Well, doctors are very, very busy people, and they don't necessarily have the time to do their due diligence in reading scientific literature. Sometimes all they do is read the abstract or the Reader's Digest version of studies, and they don't see whether or not the study was well constructed in the first place.
In other words, a drug company which did the research and produces the drug and stands to make millions, if not billions, markets this drug to a doctor, and they just read a little Reader's Digest version of how effective this drug is?
Right, and in many cases, the abstract or the Reader's Digest version does not coincide with the findings of the study. So it's a huge conflict right from the get-go.
Folks, I often tell you what I find so annoying about Pam Colleen is not only that she has strong opinions on so many things, which I love, by the way, but is that she is constantly throwing research at me, and more recently, this really annoying habit of bringing world experts on all of these subjects to our show. Actually, I absolutely love you for it, Pam, and you have another guest this morning.
Right, and this woman is a MD, PhD, and an associate professor of medicine and associate professor of family and preventative medicine at University of California, San Diego. Her name is Dr. Beatrice Golom, and she joins us from California. Good morning. It's early for you, Beatrice.
Yes, it is, but it's a pleasure to be here.
Doctor, thanks so much for joining us this morning, and we really apologize that our dollar is beating up your dollar mercilessly.
Stop that, please.
Well, that's a topic for another day.
Okay.
Doctor, we've been chatting about drugs. We trust our family doctors to give us good, well-researched advice on these powerful drugs. Should we be trusting them?
Well, that's a very good question, and I think the vast majority of doctors are very well-intentioned. As Pam pointed out, they often do not have time to read the literature carefully, but in their defense, even if they read the literature extremely carefully, the balance of information that they would get from that published literature would not actually match the evidence or the facts. And we know this from a number of actual studies that have been undertaken. One is the study that was done by FDA analysts, published by Turner et al., in, I believe it was New England Journal of Medicine, but it might have been Journal of the American Medical Association, in which they actually got access to at least the drug company's versions of data from a large number of antidepressant drug trials. One thing that some of the major medical journals have done is they have insisted that clinical trials, the major, quote, double-blind, randomized controlled trials, be entered into registries before they are initiated in order for that journal to consider accepting that journal, that study, once it is published. And what Turner et al. Found was that there were 38 studies that appeared to be favorable to antidepressant drugs, of which 37 were published. There were 36 which did not appear to be favorable, of which 22 were not published. 22 were not published at all, and 11 were published in a fashion that misleadingly made it look as though the outcome were favorable. So that there were only three of the not favorable studies that were published as though they were not favorable.
Let me see if I understand what you just said. You're saying the drug companies, they want to make money.
Correct.
To do that, they come up with products which they want to sell to doctors.
Correct.
They do the research.
Correct.
They have an agenda. They, after spending millions to develop the drug has to succeed because they've invested all this money.
Correct.
And then they give the doctors a little blurb, a little abstract, a little Reader's Digest explanation of how effective the drug is, and the doctor is seduced. And then on the side, the drug company offers the doctor little inducements, like a trip for their family to Spain. And that's how the decisions are made about drugs.
Let me go back. So the trips to Spain were quite common a couple of decades ago, seldom occur now. But even if the doctor looks well beyond the little blurb, the abstract, which often is misleading relative to the whole article, even if they were to look at the articles often look favorable, even if the findings are not. And in fact, according to this study, in that particular case of antidepressant drugs, a doctor looking at the literature, it would appear that over 90% of the trials were favorable compared to reality, which was about 51%, at least based on FDA analysts. So this is essentially the difference between what looks unanimously favorable to the diligent physician who's read all the literature versus a coin toss, which was reality.
Are you saying that our doctors, and you haven't given any numbers or percentages, our doctors are snake oil salesmen?
Not, again, the doctors. These are the studies that are published in the clinical clinical literature, in the journals, that allow the doctors to get information that they then use to treat their patients. So I think the concept behind snake oil salesmen would imply that they were aware that that what they were purveying may not always be effective. And I think that is not what the issue is. The issue is that even if they are very diligent and read the literature, the information that they have access to is misleading and may lead them indirectly to be snake oil salesmen, but not out of malintent.
No, not at all. Dr. Guillaume, you talk about the training in medical schools and how doctors are really not trained on how to evaluate evidence. And you say about 99% of doctors simply don't know because they haven't had adequate training. Do you think that this type of training could be installed in the universities?
I think it could. I don't think I've ever given a figure like 99%. But it is the case that there is no formal training in evaluation of evidence in medical school. And in my opinion, this is such a fundamental thing, almost as important as reading and writing and arithmetic, that the reality is probably there should be training throughout schooling on evaluation of evidence. What is confounding? What is bias? How do you identify it? You know, how can subjects be selected to make them non-representative? All of those things are very fundamental to interpreting evidence, and physicians have no formal training. At best, they've taken a statistics course, but statistics courses only, they assume that the data that you got are not biased and do not have confounding, and then you manipulate the numbers. So even a statistics course is completely inadequate for proper evaluation of evidence. And since the medical literature will change dramatically from the time a physician exits medical school, assuming he can actually believe what he learned in medical school, which is a separate issue, but for the rest of his life, he or she needs to be able to look at the medical literature and at least interpret what's in the medical literature, which, as we mentioned, may already be a distortion of the truth.
Now, with regards to the people who are actually publishing this data, you talk a lot about the conflicts of interest. That's one of the main things you look at. Now, conflicts of interest are epidemic today in the scientific literature. Can you talk about how we can solve this problem? Because, you know, full disclosure sometimes just isn't enough.
that is a very important point. Disclosing a conflict of interest does not protect against the conflict of interest, and it does not permit a reader to infer which of the statements were influenced in what way by that conflict. So what are some of the principles that we need to apply to reduce the impact of this? I'm not sure there's any approach to eliminate that impact, but among the ways that we need to reduce the impact are the people who generate practice guidelines that tell doctors how they need to treat a condition like depression or like high cholesterol or like high blood pressure, those people at minimum need to be people with zero financial conflict of interest with the company. They need to be people who are trained specifically in evaluation of evidence and inference. And that is not the case right now. I think this actually just became a published to-do in relation to medical devices, where it was ascertained yet again that members of the guideline generating committees were individuals who had industry conflicts. But the same was true with the American National Cholesterol Education Panel guidelines, in which all but one of the guideline generating members had industry conflicts of interest, which were initially not disclosed. They were only disclosed when they were outed by an investigative reporter.
Doctor, I have to jump in because we have to take a break, but I want to tell you, when I was a little boy and I was taught that everything was black and white and most people were totally good and honest, I did have a sneaking suspicion about this concept of conflict of interest. In my little hometown of Alvinston, there was one man who owned the ambulance service.
Mm-hmm.
As was common in many towns in Ontario, he also owned the funeral home. Okay, do you want to go the quick route or do you want to take the scenic route? And he also owned an estate furniture store above the funeral home.
Oh,
I was about 10 years old, and something way down in my brain said, you know what?
This does not feel good.
This does not feel good. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, I want to ask you, how does a doctor live with himself, herself, when we've had Vioxx, when we've had thalidomide, when we've had Avandia, when we've had so many other drugs, which turned out later to have horrible side effects, and if you didn't read the literature, you could just listen to the commercials on ABC's Evening News every night about the impact of some of these drugs. What do we do about it? Dr. Beatrice Golome will be back with you in just a moment right here on London Today on News Talk 1290 CJBK. And Pam Colleen is in the house this morning along with a very special friend. And Pam, you had a line this morning that just rocked me, as you do every week. And you said, even if poison is free, it's not much of a deal if it's poison.
Yeah, it's still not a good deal when we get free poison. So here in socialized medicine, of course, people get drugs. And unfortunately, these drugs can have terrible side effects and not really, secondarily, address the main issues as to why people are sick in the first place. So they get free poison prescribed to them. And to me, you know, free poison is never a good deal.
We're in conversation from California with Dr. Beatrice Golome. Now, doctor, you are a medical doctor.
Correct.
At what point did you have this epiphany when you were recommending these drugs and writing these prescriptions that, oh, crap, this may be hurting my patients instead of healing them?
Well, I think when I was in medical residency, actually when I was a medical intern, which is sort of the first year that you're semi-independent, for our annual retreat, I wrote a poem entitled Dispensing Side Effects. Because I had begun to be very troubled by the fact that a lot of the drugs we gave caused health problems in addition to helping some. And in many cases, the balance of harm to benefit was not clear. And then when I began studying a class of drugs, statin cholesterol-lowering drugs, I began to be confused about why it was that what I saw in my clinical practice departed from the published evidence, and why the published evidence in turn departed from the guidelines, with the published evidence looking more favorable than what I saw, and with the guidelines in turn being more favorable, that is to say, advising drug use in many more people than even the published evidence would indicate. And that is when I began exploring these issues and understanding them better. Among the many studies that I identified that helped to understand this was the study during the time when, before statins, a different class of drug called calcium channel blockers, which were blood pressure lowering drugs, were at that time the most prescribed class of drugs. And then a few people began to identify that apparently a subclass of these drugs increased heart and stroke problems rather than reducing them. And there was a period of intense debate in which somebody analyzed whether people's stated opinions in scientific articles were favorable, neutral, or adverse about these drugs in relationship to their drug company conflict of interest.
Just to make a crude comparison, there was a time in the auto industry where when they had a defect in their car, and there were all these reports in the media, I'm thinking of Ford Tempo, for example, but a whole string of other cars, the rule was deny, deny, deny. The moment you admit it, you are dead. Now the thinking is totally the opposite, that you should be right out in front of any speculation about a defect. You just announce it, you do the recall, and the problem is looked after. If a drug company...
Wait. And you're aware of the recent issue with Toyota, that was not the approach that they used.
No, they didn't. No, that
right,
they...
and it's not the approach that seems to be used again and again and again with drugs, which is initially deny, discredit, delay, etc. And in fact, there are a number of cases in which we have published evidence of industry working very hard to discredit individuals who spoke out about drugs, in which jobs were actually lost by individuals. Nancy Oliveri in your Canada is one of the examples of somebody whom industry tried to take down when she exposed adverse effects of drugs. And despite winning every sort of objective evaluation that's ever been undertaken, including in your legal system, she's still tied up in litigation many years later. Despite having won the original lawsuit and millions of dollars in punitive damages, she has yet to receive a dime of that money, has lost her job about five times. Her university, of course, was also standing to get money from that drug company, and so rather than defending her, they were at least as vigorous initially in attacking her. So it's a very big issue.
What an absolute perfect script for a movie, to have a drug company executive wake up in the middle of the night sweating because he realizes the drug that his company has spent millions on is killing people, not helping them. Now he's in an incredibly difficult moral dilemma.
Well, and we have this problem that, and I'm not exactly sure how the system works in Canada, but in the U.S., we have this idea that drug companies can both be publicly traded companies, which means their primary obligation is to make a profit for their stockholders. And so they must simultaneously have their stockholders' best interests at heart and patients' best interests at heart. And those are mutually incompatible primary goals. These are companies, and their job is to make money, and they use every resource at their disposal to do that. They're very effective in doing that. They do that, as we have now learned, by influencing the medical journals themselves, which are generally for-profit companies that make their profits by a combination of drug company advertising and, incidentally, sales of glossy reprints of drug company favorable articles back to industry for what can amount to $1 million a year. So that there's a strong incentive for journals to publish favorable articles. We know of cases where drug companies also rejected drug unfavorable articles explicitly for marketing reasons rather than because of the quality of the paper. We know about that because one editor-in-chief actually put it in writing to the article of the to the author of the unfavorable article. He said, you know, while I and all three reviewers think this paper should be published, I have been overruled by our marketing department.
What are you saying? We're going to have to go to a break in just a moment for a news update. What are you saying? That Vioxx could
have... themselves have functionally become an arm of industry. And in fact, four former editors-in-chief of major medical journals, two for New England Journal of Medicine, also BMJ, Lancet, have actually penned tomes decrying the impact of industry on medical publishing.
What I hear you saying is Vioxx could happen again.
Yes, that's absolutely true. And when we get back, I'd actually like to share something additional that was not commented on in relationship to Vandia that is even more troubling.
Oh, dear.
Oh, my goodness. Okay, short break for a news update. Dr. Beatrice Golom back with us in just a moment. Very disturbing stuff. When we come back in just a moment, right here on London Today on News Talk 1290 CJBK.
1290.
Pam Colleen is in the house. We're in conversation with Dr. Beatrice Golom from California. Doctor, I have a question for you.
Yes?
I have a question for you. Are you familiar with Tim Hortons?
Yes. Wait, go back.
I have been wrestling with what would be more catastrophic to Canadians if their local food store were to suddenly shut down, if their local beer store were to suddenly shut down, or what I think is more likely, if their local Tim Hortons, and we now have one on every corner in Canada, and sometimes, like at Hamilton and Highbury, two Tim Hortons on one corner. In the States, I guess what you have is a Walgreens on every corner.
In some areas, yes. We also have CVS and a few other.
So what would be most traumatic for Americans if the food store closed, the beer store, or Walgreens?
I'm not sure I would like to make that comparison.
What I'm trying to do is make this point, that as Americans and Canadians are right behind, get fatter and sicker and more depressed, and you got the aging demographics, you are going to see a Walgreens store virtually on every corner because we've become absolutely addicted to prescription drugs.
Right. Prescription drugs are absolutely overused. Absolutely.
Now, just before the break, you were going to tell us about Avandia.
Right. And so at the beginning, when the two of you were discussing Vioxx, Avandia, and thalidomide, it was commented rightly that physicians often read only the abstracts, and the abstracts can be a misleading representation of the paper. But something has emerged specifically in the Avandia case that we had all hoped was not the case. The hope had been that that there was selective publishing of the favorable findings and selective representation and selective inferences, but that the basic data that were provided, for instance, to the FDA were accurate. But there's been a several-year sort of debate within our Food and Drug Administration between the safety office, which actually tried putting a black box warning on Avandia and Actos some years ago, and the new drug office, which complained when that happened, and they actually demoted functionally the person who put the black box warning and made her retract the warning. But now somebody in the new drug office, Tom Arciniak, did something virtually unprecedented. He actually looked not just at the database provided by the company, but went back and compared it to the individual patient records. Because, and this is for a specific trial on Avandia called the Record Trial, which the Glaxo had done and had said, look, this trial shows that those pesky concerns about cardiovascular risk based on those other trials were grossly exaggerated. Well, when Tom Arciniak looked at a number of these patient records, of course, it's very time intensive and he didn't go through all of them, but he went through enough to find that the drug company had omitted or erased from the record a number of serious cardiovascular adverse events, a hospitalization for a brain hemorrhage, that is a brain bleed, a 67-day hospitalization for stroke, a patient who had died of a serious heart problem. The problem was recast as a death from an unknown but non-heart-related cause. And once he got to 12 of these, that was, he stopped. That was enough for this trial not only not to countermand the concerns that had been raised by the other trials, but to actually support them. And this suggests that it may not just be the issue of selective publication of favorable findings and selective inferences drawn from these, but that there may actually be manipulation of the data themselves in these clinical trials, which is, of course, very disturbing and calls into question the whole of the medical literature in a still more fundamental way.
But doesn't this call into question as well the competency of FDA and Health Canada for not catching these problems before these drugs hit the market?
No kidding.
So that's an interesting question. And my understanding, and this is based, this is based on what I've heard from somebody else, and I've never verified this, but I had been told that the FDA some years back had offered the drug industry the option that they could make approvals easier if they would do what's called active post-marketing adverse event surveillance. This is done in New Zealand. This means that at least if a drug is released, there's actual following of at least a representative subset of the people who get that drug in order to see if they're having problems. We have no such formal process in the U.S. There's just a passive reporting system where doctors, if they want to, can report adverse effects on drugs.
But only 1 to 10% of adverse events are recorded.
It may be lower than that. That number is made up based on an unknown denominator. And when I was doing some work for RAND, which is a think tank in Santa Monica, evaluated the issue of anthrax adverse effect, anthrax vaccine adverse effect. And in that case, we have direct data because somebody actually eventually did active prospective follow-up. And the data based on the reporting system were that, one in 10,000, adverse effects. Whereas the data on active prospective follow-up actually were on the order of 40 to 70% adverse effects. So it went from, it was, a difference of multiple orders of magnitude. And on top of that, the difference between adverse effects being very rare and very common.
Doctor, let me just jump in with a question here. And that is this, to make a comparison to the profession that I'm in, radio. One of the reasons I didn't go to a small town like Leamington or Tilsonburg is the horror stories I heard from colleagues about working in a newsroom there where the local GM dealer, for example, would buy 50% of the advertising for the station. So if his son got busted for drugs, there was just an understanding. You didn't report that. When I watch ABC News in the evening and I see commercial after commercial from Big Pharma, I'm thinking, okay, Diane Sawyer, when is the last time ABC News did a story on what they should be doing, the stuff that you're talking about?
Right, and that's not an issue where I've, closely explored what the evidence is in relationship to the possibility of conflict of interest in reporting. But it is troubling, again, when there is a commercial conflict of interest associated with people who are serving as watchdogs.
Mm-hmm. Now, Dr. Golom, I want to talk to you about one of the areas that you've been heavily exploring, and that is the statin drugs. Maybe what you can start by telling us is some of the names of the statin drugs on the market. I know Lipitor is probably the top-selling statin.
Right, and Crestor, because it has the most recent patent, is rapidly gaining ground. And then Zocor and Pravacol, Mevacor, and formerly Bacol, that was ultimately withdrawn from the market due to rhabdomyolysis, which is a serious muscle breakdown problem that can be potentially fatal. All of the statins can cause that. Bacol seemed to cause it in higher numbers, but in part this proved to be primarily when it was given in combination with another cholesterol-lowering drug that more inhibited metabolism of Bacol than the other one. So that problem occurs across all of the statin drugs, but appeared to be more common without.
So there's damage being done to the muscle, but isn't the heart a muscle?
The heart is a muscle, and that's a very underexplored area. I will certainly say that when we did our randomized trial, we actually had some people who seemed to develop chest pain, or at least reported to me after their participation in the study that they had had chest pain while they were a participant, and when they were unblinded, they had been on a statin. And I've also had patients where I've been unsure, was the statin helping or hurting, but I did a trial of withdrawing the statin and their chest pain resolved. So I believe that there are instances where the statin is causing heart problems in the same way that we know it causes other muscle problems, which is by affecting the energy supply to the muscle.
Doctor, I'm just thinking about the drug chains that we have in Canada. We have a Shoppers Drug Mart, we have a Rexall, locally we have IDA. What fraction of the drugs that are in these stores would come into the category of, we can absolutely trust them because the research is so scientific and so solid, we know that those drugs do what the doctors and the medical companies claim they do without an extra high risk of serious medical side effects?
I'm not even sure I want to hazard a guess, because every once in a while, even for drugs that have been on the market for very long periods of time, some of those came on the market during a time when there weren't as high of standards for approval. And unless you formally do the study to evaluate a specific adverse effect, you may not know what the effect is on that outcome. So I'm not sure we can be positive, ever for any drug. And I wouldn't want to give a fraction. I'm sorry.
But the new drugs on the market are being painted as being very sexy, very, that this is cutting edge medicine and so on and so forth. But really, some of the research is just saying that the old drugs are just as good and even
that,
better.
That is often the case. And in fact, an analysis that was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association some years ago found that, that one-fifth of all drugs that have undergone full testing and been fully approved by the FDA for open release to the market will eventually either be withdrawn from the market or have major black box warnings for serious side effects that weren't identified before the drug was released. Mm. And generally what I tell my patients is, let's let somebody else's patients be the guinea pigs. Mm-hmm. If a drug is relatively new to the market, unless there's an absolutely compelling reason for that drug to be used, I would rather go with the drugs that have more of a track record of safety and evaluation.
When the doctor reads this little abstract about how safe the drug is and how effective, Dr. Beatriz Golom, how contaminated is the material, the literature that they're reading?
Well, that's a very interesting question, and that was actually directly analyzed in an article that was published in Annals of Internal Medicine some years ago, in which reportedly objective analysts who were familiar with the specific drugs being advertised found that a substantial fraction of those advertisements had information that was misleading in terms of the balance of risks and benefits. And actually that study had a major impact in yet another way, which was Annals of Internal Medicine, that journal that published that article, lost a giant amount of advertising revenue as a consequence of publishing this article that was unfavorable to drug company advertising. Mm-hmm. Somebody actually tracked their revenues against other medical journals and the expected revenues compared to the actual revenues over the ensuing 1.5 years, over the ensuing 4 years, the estimate was that they lost on the order of $1 to $1.5 million in drug company advertising. And a lot of the other medical journals sat up and took notice. Again, medical journals are all the major journals are businesses. And they are for-profit companies that make their money from drug company advertising and other forms of money, primarily from industry rather than from subscribers.
Doctor, we have to take one more short break. And when we come back, I want to ask you two key questions. I have friends who are doctors.
Mm-hmm.
They're good people.
Yes.
They're moral people.
That's correct.
They go to great lengths. In fact, one of my heroes in London, Dr. Tim Fruin, I'm wondering how they sleep at night if they know what you're telling us. So that's the number one question. And then secondly, who's out there protecting us from bad prescription drugs? We thought it was our doctors. We thought it was our medical associations. We thought it was our governments. We thought it was media. Where are they in all of this? Back in just a moment here in London today on News Talk 1290, CJBK.
643-1290.
Just chatting with Pam Colleen during the break and Dr. Beatriz Golom. A word came up. I want to ask you about this particular drug before I ask you the earlier two questions. Birth control pill for young women. Yes. What are the claims that were made and what is the reality that is now coming to light?
I'm actually just going to slide on that question. That's not an area that I've investigated closely.
Okay. Now, who's protecting us from drugs? Like Vioxx.
That is a pivotally important question. And almost all of the natural protective agents have functionally become arms of industry. So academic medical centers often rely on money from drug companies actually to put up buildings, to fund projects, et cetera. There actually are people who are senior vice presidents of drug companies and so forth who are, put up for academic positions at medical schools. Physicians who do research are often funded by drug companies. And in fact, we have the fabled Merck neutralized memos that came out during the disclosure process for litigation in relation to Vioxx, where internal memos from this drug company discussed how do you, quote, using their terms, neutralize, unquote, problem physicians. And the approaches that were, which meant physicians that actually say unfavorable things about their drug or say things that favor a competitor's drug over their drug. And the approaches that were used included the more benign things like funding them to give talks and giving them grants to the more troubling things, the stick end of the carrot and stick, which is, we may need to seek them out where they live and destroy them. That was actually in a Merck memo. So there are a relatively small number of doctors who try to speak out on this issue. What is the incentive for them? They stand to be challenged. Their own universities may not love them because they want to get money from industry as well. There's certainly no profit in it for them to do this. it's only if they have very strong moral conviction, and relatively few people are sort of stalwart enough to do that. Medical schools, as I mentioned, the academic medical centers now have entrenched conflicts of interest often. Government in the U.S., in order to be elected for office, it requires a lot of funding, and there are more drug company lobbyists in Washington, D.C. than there are congresspeople. And on both sides of the political aisle, people take lots of money from drug companies. And a survey of FDA officials found that a substantial number of them were familiar with cases in which political appointees had, quote, inappropriately inserted themselves into FDA decisions.
Doctor, hate to interrupt, but we only have a couple of moments left, and there's a couple of key areas I want to cover. I have a friend who is in the home building business. For the last several years, he's been building a cottage on the shores of one of the lakes up in the Muskokas, and he keeps inviting me to see this house. Unbelievable, a palace times 10, and they keep building. It is owned by a drug company executive. It just dramatizes the point that we are talking about billions of dollars. Are you saying that Big Pharma, because there are billions of dollars, have bought off doctors, have bought off medical associations, have bought off governments, have bought off media, and have endangered all of us because their agenda is about money and nobody's big enough to expose the truth about their research?
Yeah, I would say that's substantially true. There's one more group that they have often functionally bought off, which are actually patient advocacy groups. It turns out that a number of them are funded and even founded by the so-called grassroots patient advocacy groups, are funded and sometimes even founded by drug companies. And in the U.S., because these are nonprofits, they don't have to disclose the source of funding, and these groups then often do lobbying aligned with drug companies' interests, so that it looks like the group that most has a stake in this issue and would serve as a counterweight often functionally does not. Having said this, let me say that all of the information that I discussed did actually come from people who did, you know, expose elements of this. There are investigative reporters who have tried to take this on. There are physicians and scientists who have tried to take this on. There are, you know, some rules and regulations related to conflict of interest that are coming in, but they are serving as a very small counterweight to a very, very big issue.
Well, what about the medical schools? I know you talk about this story, and it's widely known on the internet, is this story about the Harvard medical student who asked his professor about the side effects to statin drugs, and the professor was very dismissive, and when the student went home and looked up the associations that the professor had, he found hordes of conflicts of interest. So even the medical schools are contaminated.
That's a very serious problem. And I'm going to say I knew there was a problem before that came out at Harvard Medical School, because one of my husbands, who's a scientist, he has a colleague that we were having dinner with, and the colleague's daughter was at Harvard Medical School. And he said that after she heard their lecture on statins, she told her father, make sure you remind me the day I turn 30 to go on statins. Now, let me say, this is a class of drug that has never shown a hint of survival benefit in any group of women, even women with heart disease. So, you know, I knew that the information was highly spun. The reality, unfortunately, is that people who study drugs, I am an extreme anomaly in that I have tried very hard to have a career with, you know, not taking any money from drug companies. But I believe I am literally the only person that I am aware of that studies drugs and does trials on drugs and doesn't take industry money. It's a very difficult thing to do.
Doctor, really quickly.
Most of the people available to give the lectures who have the expertise are people who unfortunately have a conflict.
Doctor, you've been saying some explosive things. We have just mere seconds left. Have you ever been threatened by the drug company or leaned on?
I have not been directly leaned on, but usually the evidence suggests that the third-party technique is used, and I have had a member of my own department try to internally, shall we say, take me down, which is, again, you know, analogous to what happened with Nancy Oliveri, where people who get money from industry are often used, you know, to make it look like it's an objective third party.
Doctor, we have to leave it there. I can't believe how you've turned an hour into about 6.5 minutes. Just absolutely explosive and fascinating stuff. We thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Gallome.
Where could, Pam, where could people find out more if they wanted to read more about Dr. Gallome?
Well, I know that there's YouTube interviews with her. She is on the university website, but if people just Google in Dr. Beatrice Gallome.
How do you spell her last name?
G-O-L-O-M-B. They'll find her through the internet.
Pam, absolutely amazing, wasn't she?
She's amazing.
Wow. I'm going to go home and eat some broccoli. hands on the wheel, eyes on the road. Please hang up and drive so you arrive alive, and be careful about the drugs you take, even prescription drugs. Be safe. We'll see you tomorrow morning at 9, right here on London Today on News Talk 1290 CJBK.